All right, so here's my movie idea.
What is it?
What we do is time is non-linear. It's folded on top of itself from the future and the past.
Okay.
So ghosts are just visions of the past and future bleeding into our reality.
That's what they are.
Where it's like, wait.
Keep going. You guys want to talk about what this week's podcast is about?
What are we here for?
You're telling me that it wasn't about ghosts?
No, I'm here to talk about anime all the time, baby, because that's all we talk about now. Sometimes we become a Mad Max podcast, and then other times we become an anime podcast.
This is really our conclusion, though, to the anime arc, right?
Yeah.
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 My anime redemption arc is, you know, I'm going Super Saiyan with it.
Yeah. You did that just so we could put the hair on you, right? Yeah.
That's I need some hair, so
yeah. I knew exactly what you were going for there.
Well, this week, we mentioned in the last week's podcast episode, but we're going to talk about Princess Mononoke.
Before we do that, though, should we introduce our boy?
Yeah, we can totally do that.
Boy.
Come on up to that microphone there, because we got someone new in the studio today. And what his title is... Behind the scenes guy right now. What are we calling him?
That's the title, behind the scenes guy.
Basically, though, he's here to, he's going to be editing the podcast. He's helping us shoot the podcast. Mm-hmm. He's also like a fact checker. So when Brad starts saying that every president ever was left-handed, we can say...
Yeah, he gets all his information from Watch Mojo. We've learned.
We can start saying, hold on, Brad. We're not sure that every president was left-handed.
What did it say? It was like actually the last four... Like, Barack Obama was left-handed, Bill Clinton was left-handed, George H.W. was left-handed, Ronald Reagan was left-handed, then they forced them to be
right-handed. Yeah, but the video was like, a majority of presidents have been left-handed, and then you looked up the facts, and it was like, less than 10% of
See,
like...
But here's the thing about being left-handed, though, and then we'll introduce our man over here, but you can claim anyone before like a certain time in the 1900s could have been left-handed because for the longest time they forced people
they were
to
demons.
Be right-handed. Yeah,
yeah.
They thought they were ghosts or demons or witches if they were left-handed.
Could have been is the key word. So. These are facts, Brad. What you're talking in is myths.
That's right.
Okay.
Carry on, Brad.
Introduction. So yeah, let's introduce Andrew.
Andrew, say hello.
Hello.
Perfect. So yeah, if you've watched the show, you might have heard Ryan in the past. He was kind of doing a similar.
There was a freak shark attack with him, and
Well, he went to San Antonio with us. Let's just say he didn't come back. So now we've got Andrew.
That sounds like we killed him. like we took him to another state and killed him.
Fact check: most serial killers are left-handed. Brad.
Yep. See. So get a little closer to that mic there too. But so now we know we went to San Antonio, one of us didn't come back, and Brad's left-handed, and so is Ellis. So we got two serial killers possibly that were on this trip.
You guys don't see Luke in a few episodes.
I'm not here like next week per se, then he might have killed me.
Oh, man, if that went in line with your vacation, you actually weren't here, that
I'm really
would be
not
insane.
Here. Yeah, okay, that was it. That was my joke.
Oh.
All right.
Oops.
So.
Okay.
We're getting off track.
Were we ever on track?
No, we didn't even do like an intro or anything, but that's okay. We don't need it.
We don't need intros where we're going.
Yeah.
So, Princess Mononoke. Okay.
Yeah, let's get into it.
All right. So
let's tell people what it kind of is.
What it's about, the synopsis.
Yeah. Yeah.
Brad, you want to give a synopsis of Princess Mononoke? I feel like you're.
I got it right here.
Yeah,
we can just,
you can read
Luke,
it.
Would you love to give a synopsis of Princess
I'm just
going to
give you a little info from Wikipedia here. So, I mean, it came out in 1997, which was a great year.
What else came out in 1997?
I would say my sister graduated from high school.
I was thinking Titanic, but
Titanic. What year did Vanilla Sky come out? Like 2000 or something like that.
Andrew,
check that out for us. It's your first Google of the day.
2000.
First Google.
I don't know why, but just Vanilla Sky popped in my head because
That was 2001.
Cool.
2001.
Correct.
And what was Fight Club, like 98?
99, I believe.
99. Dang.
You can look that up too.
Yeah.
99.
Yeah.
99. Okay. Well, so this is 97, Japanese epic fantasy film written and directed by Miyazaki. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to say the first name. Do you?
Hayao? I think it's
Hayao.
Hayao Miyazaki. And of course, it's a Studio Ghibli film. I remember talking about them in film school a little bit. Let's see, where's some of the actual synopsis here?
If you're familiar with Studio Ghibli, they did My Neighbor Totoro, Spirited Away,
Howl's Moving Castle,
Kiki's Delivery Service.
Yeah,
a lot of kind of the more family friendly, you know, anime.
Except
right?
for Mononoke. So
yes.
Yeah. So they were kind of like the Disney or something of the of
pretty
anime.
Much. He drew a lot of inspiration from Disney.
Yeah, I definitely could feel that watching this film and. I know, I guess we'll get into it more soon, but it's set in the Lake Muromachi period of Japan, which was a long, long time ago.
I think it was like 13th century or something like that.
It says 1336 to 1573, so
that's
CE.
It's like the height of like samurais and like whenever you think of like kind of like old school Japan lore and like history,
this is
it's like that time period.
Yeah. So it basically, here's the story in a nutshell. It follows a young Emishi prince named Ashitaka, and his involvement in a struggle between the gods of a forest and the humans who consume its resources. And that's pretty much the story. The term Mononoke is not a name, but a Japanese word for supernatural, shape-shifting beings that possess people and cause suffering, disease, or death.
The word has actually evolved over time, too. It has multiple different meanings. The beginning of it, in its early period, was more, it meant, like, vengeful spirit. So she'd be, like, the princess of, like, the vengeful spirits or something like that. And it's evolved into more, at least in the modern day, it means an unknowable thing, kind of like an enigma. So it's really cool because it has all these like meanings that are layered into the word that all coincide with the story of Princess Mononoke.
That's pretty cool. So who is Princess Mononoke?
San. She's a daughter who was adopted by the wolf spirit. And she was basically raised as one of the cubs. She was the third cub in the pack, hence her name.
Did her parents like just like throw her out to the wolves or something? I forget what they said.
It was pretty much like a survival moment, as far as I interpreted it, where
it's like they were feeding
their child and offering it so that they could get away.
Yeah, because I knew they were talking about how, you know, humans, you know, because a lot of it's about humans, how they suck.
I feel like the theme is really the consequences of like industrialism and mankind against nature. It's a very environmental film.
Yeah.
Which is really cool because it plays into like traditional Shintoism like beliefs, because Shintoism is basically like a at its core about man coinciding with nature, existing as one in like this harmony. And this film is very much kind of like the way he did it was, this was a post World War II commentary for Miyazaki, where he was really upset with Japan because they were starting to hit their like industrialism and like they were kind of reaching that metropolis like capitalistic society that they are today, and they were foregoing their like Shinto roots and kind of like all of the history and like, I don't want to say folklore, but mythos and stuff that kind of went into that religion. So he made this as a commentary to help people before they were too far gone not lose touch with
the nature side,
the history and the nature and everything that kind of like that religion did for Japan and its early history.
Cool. I feel like that's almost a major theme in a lot of his movies, at least the ones I've seen, where it's not as much technology. Like, compare it to what we watched the last episode. Akira is so technology driven and kind of almost a similar message in a way of like showing the downside of being so, you know, technology advanced and like how it can almost corrupt and really ruin, you know, the city, the people in it. But this is almost more, hey, let's draw back to our roots.
Exactly. which I really appreciate, because like he's trying to like preserve their heritage and their culture that is kind of being lost and like merging into like, because we've had like such, there used to be like such a communication gap between like different countries in the mm-hmm. world, and we've like hit a point now where it's almost like the language barriers and stuff are like non-existent.
Yeah.
Right. And so we're kind of like seeing these blends of different cultures and societies into right. like into one, and you're losing the individual out, or you know, the individualism of different societies and the history of what that culture kind of went through.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's cool. Did you like the movie, Luke?
I did. Being
your first time?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I loved it. So far, it was the first one I felt like in terms of connecting with it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Again, I did watch, it was dubbed, and yes. And that was the only option I had on HBO Max. I mean, I just pulled it up and started playing, and I was like, I guess this is it. But so I guess, did they went back and reanimated the lips to match the English version?
They do that for most of them now. Sometimes it's not perfect because they're like, for shows they're trying to rush through, they have like a time mm-hmm. constraint.
Yeah.
But for the movies, they go through, as far as I know, and they edit the mouths to match the English dub.
Yeah, because it was like pretty spot on. I was like, well, wow, how is this working? But I figured they must have reanimated it. But I liked the movie a lot, and the animation I thought was really cool, and the score was fantastic.
Oh, the music, mm-hmm. that's the one thing that Japan, I feel like since the 90s moving forward, their music, they nail it in just about everything they do. That like, their art style, like
there's kinda, and maybe we could like play a little clip while we're talking, you know, and when we edit this, but there's like this main theme is like so cool. I love the melody of the main theme. And they do it multiple times throughout the film, but man, it's such a pretty score. And you know, I think music's a big thing for me for sure in mm-hmm. terms of just connecting with the film. And I think also I connected with these characters a lot. I didn't think there was as much of the sort of cheesiness that we've seen in some of the other anime. Like, it seemed like it translated more.
Yeah. I would say some of the dialogue is, at least watching it in dub, because I did as well, is so apparently, like, not great. Like, at the beginning, when he's talking with the monk, mm-hmm. when he first meets the monk and they're sharing the soup together, some of the dialogue feels, like, so rushed and stupid.
Yeah, I just remembered a part.
Like, I love that character, the monk.
Yeah.
He's voiced by Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah, Billy Bob Thornton in this is just, it's so weird hearing him in this cartoon and seeing what his character looks
like. It's insane.
But dude, okay, speaking of just bad dialogue, but the part where the whatever it is, the big black like blobs are coming,
the Night Walker,
they're coming towards the town, and what's his name, the main character,
Ashitaka.
He's warning everyone. He says a full like two paragraphs though in his like warning message, instead of just like run, he goes like this. He's like, run, don't let the black stuff touch you. It's very dangerous. I'm going to go back and try to stop it. So you guys get to the water, and I'm going to run back this way. And dude, it goes on that line. I'm like, what? And all the while, this thing's still moving forward. And the people are listening like, should we run now? It's so funny, dude.
My only other issue with the dialogue, and this is maybe more so character motivation than dialogue, is at the very end when Billy Bob Thornton's character, like, he's like, I guess he can just have the head back. And then he's like, can't beat him, join him.
Yeah.
And he's like, this main bad guy's like, oh, well.
He just gives up real easy.
I was like, cool.
Yeah, oh, man. Billy Bob Thornton, though, man. That was super weird.
His voice is almost too iconic, I feel like.
I think so, too. It definitely took me out of it a little bit. I couldn't stop thinking about Billy Bob Thornton.
Jada Pinkett Smith's voice. I forgot who she voiced in the movie, but it's like listening to her, I don't know, and knowing that she was in it, it just quickly made me think of that video that came out where her and Will Smith were talking about the entanglement.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And I was like, oh, man.
We got involved in an entanglement. Yeah.
Also, the voice of the boar, the one who has, like, the crust in his eyes.
The blind?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He, I don't know if you guys will know this, but in Halo 3, he was the voice of the Arbiter, and I couldn't, like...
Get that.
I just can't unsee that character, like, the Arbiter, as this, like, pig person. It's so
wrong. It's that's just a downside of, like, any...
voice acting?
Voice acting, though, especially... I mean, Pixar movies are that way, too. Like, eventually, I feel like everyone just went, okay, Tom Hanks is the voice of Woody. We'll just roll with it, you know? And it works now, but, you know, probably when it came out and people were used to him being, you know, the guy from, you know, Forrest Gump.
Right.
Yeah.
Something that was...
What if Woody talked like Forrest Gump? But the
there's probably a YouTube video of that.
Buzz.
But it was like I was playing, I guess I was playing Uncharted, and you told me that the voice was, what's his name, from The Last of Us?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then after that, I was like, oh, girl, now I can't unsee it. Like, I'd hear him talk, and I was like, that's all I'm seeing is this character.
I know, dude. It's something you have to look past sometimes, because you almost, like, can't get the other character out of your head.
Yeah.
So what's the... So you're saying it's called the Night... Walker crawler,
the big thing? The Night Walker is the thing that the forest spirit turns into at
like
midnight
when it's in the sky, and it's like the crazy tendrils up in the sky, kind of.
It's like the first time you see it.
You talking about the giant
creature? End. At the end, when it gets like the head cut off,
that's
and then
the
it turns.
Forest god.
The forest spirit is when it looks like a deer. When it turns into the big blue purple blob thing, that's the Night Walker.
Night. Okay, so. To me, I was like, wow, this looks a lot like Stranger Things when you see the...
I love the design of it.
Yeah,
I
mean, what's even it called? When the Demogorgon like turns into the big flayer, Mind flayer. When it's in the sky and it's like that. Mm-hmm. There was a part where, like this. See, look at this.
Yeah.
This looks... I was like, wow, this really reminds me of...
Yeah,
I'll save that photo so we can put it up.
Yeah, I just love the creature designs of all this. Mm-hmm. Like... I don't know.
A lot of it is like pulled directly from Japanese folklore as well. Like a lot of the designs and stuff, especially the spirit of the forest.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
That deer design with like the crazy antlers.
And then the face, almost like a human face. Yeah. To it. Yeah.
That's in so much pop culture. Really? For like, at least like Japanese stuff, like Pokemon.
And its face is like
flat. It does look very
kinda.
Pokemon.
Like, it's almost, like you said, human-like, and it doesn't like, there's no snout, or, like, when you see the profile of it, it's, like, literally, like, the face is flat, like, more like a human.
And then, like, the Nightwalker, you can see something like that in Avatar The Last Airbender, whenever he, like, he goes into the Avatar state.
I feel like this movie, if anything, because I saw it in college, our good friend of the podcast, Adam Neal, showed it to me. You know, Adam really had... played a major part in showing me a lot of anime stuff. Watching it reminded me of some of the seasons and episodes of Avatar The Last Airbender.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Which I know that was probably very much influenced by this, you know.
A lot of stuff is. Like, at the very end when all of the parts of the Nightwalker is going around that rock and they're sitting on it, that reminded me of Lord of the Rings at the end in Return of the King when the lava's like flowing around them at the end. I feel like that scene, that composition is used a lot.
Yeah.
But that's the only one I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, I think, to me, this movie is such a beautiful, like, well-done movie. You know, I think the emotional core, it, like, hits
the
way you need
it.
Yeah.
Especially, like, at the end when Irontown is, like, completely, like, covered over in greenery and stuff. Such a beautiful shot.
I just feel like it's one of those where, like, Akira is the opposite, where you have to go looking for the themes. Like, you watch it and you're like, okay, I have to read a Wikipedia article because I don't know what I just saw.
Right.
But this one is like, it really hammers it home. Like, you get it. And I think just emotionally there, it's, you know, spot on, you know.
Much more digestible, at the very least. For
But I love it, too, because, you know, I think you kind of alluded to it earlier, how, like, Miyazaki's almost like the Disney of Japanese anime, but this movie, you know, right off the bat, really quick, you know, they shoot an arrow and this guy gets, like, his arms cut off, and they just go flying.
I was so shocked. Like, yeah. Dude. The arms sliced right off and his hands, and he's standing there like, oh,
and their reactions are very Disney too. It's like they could lose a leg and they'll be like, oh, my leg.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, oh.
Yeah, it was cool though, because it seemed like he was almost in shock or something. Yeah. He's just like, what's happened to my arms?
Yeah.
But the rest of his movies are not, for the most part, not that gruesome.
Yeah. I know I've seen Spirited Away, and what's the one, the Lupin the Third?
Lupin the Third?
Yeah. Adam again showed me that one, and it was pretty cool.
He's a he's very old school. He's draws a lot of his inspiration from Shintoism. He's very anti-war. A mm-hmm. lot of his movies are kind of like centralized around yeah. anti-war. And he's just had like a fascination with Western animation, and he's, despite whatever the film is about, there's always a whimsical nature yeah. that I almost allude to, like a like Disney and Spielberg kind of like yeah, coming yeah, yeah. together.
It's super weird where it's like he takes Western animation and culture, like redirects it through his Japanese heritage and just that like viewpoint, and then it comes out, it's these awesome works of art. And then I feel like the reverse is all these American animators and filmmakers then take inspiration from his, and it's almost like this like a cyclical circle. Yeah,
you know what was really funny about that too, that we're bringing up kind of like the Western influence, is Harvey Weinstein, I believe.
Yeah,
it was
heard of him.
Yeah, Harvey Weinstein back in the day was really notorious for editing animation mm-hmm. from foreign countries and like yeah. cutting it up and trying to dilute it for a Western audience. And
of course
he did that with tons of stuff, like Snowpiercer has a story, but continue.
Well, when Princess Mononoke was supposed to come to the U.S., he was already talking about cutting out all of the things that referenced Japanese culture and history, like any of the mythological creatures he was talking
the
about.
The movie wouldn't exist.
I know, it wouldn't make any sense. And so Miyazaki sent him a real katana, like a traditional, like authentic katana with a note attached to it that simply said, "No cuts."
See, wow, that's cool. I read that, which is yeah. super cool, but that's like a little bit, because Miyazaki was asked about that later, and I guess it became some kind of urban legend to a degree.
Yeah. Oh,
it was
really?
A producer that did that. It wasn't Miyazaki himself, but he's okay. like, yeah, I was all for like not making cuts. He goes, I personally went to New York to talk to Miramax to be like, hey,
he's I'm like, not. I actually did the job of like making sure they didn't do yeah. any cuts, whereas someone sent him a thing and it's, you know, a sword and said no cuts, but I actually went there and was like, had a conversation and made sure it didn't happen.
It's funny though, because that's like a declaration of war
yeah.
from like
Japanese
yeah.
culture.
Yeah, I think Asian culture in general is like that would be like a declaration of war.
Yeah.
If you don't back down, sending someone like a katana.
Yeah, that's a really cool move either way.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's so cool, dude.
Especially when it comes to like someone cutting up your yeah. movie, your artwork, and changing it for basically just to commercialize it more, yeah. for make it more consumer friendly or whatever.
And that's the thing too, like Harvey Weinstein had done terrible, terrible stuff. But I don't understand how he got to that position where he was able to make these calls on all these foreign movies. Because I've heard plenty of stories like Bong Joon-ho with Snowpiercer had to like buck up against him. And mm-hmm. it took like a year and a half later for Snowpiercer to hit like U.S. theaters, you know, even though it was a English film, you
yeah.
know, in language, but, you know, by a South Korean film director.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I don't know how. He just had like way too much control. Too much power. Yeah.
We know now he had way too much power, yes. and mm-hmm. we also know that he was a terrible person. Yeah. So
mm-hmm.
That's unfortunately what happens sometimes where people get into those positions of power.
There's crazy
stuff, dude. So speaking of just, I guess, production stuff, like listen to this: estimated budget $23.5 million.
Wow.
Yeah.
For the 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah, late 90s.
Mostly hand-drawn, but incorporates some use of computer animation.
Yeah,
I saw that. I read
it's
that.
About only like 10% of the movie involves yep. CGI.
But they were kind of like almost like spearheading, what was it, Treasure Island, I think, that used...
Treasure Planet?
Treasure Planet that used a lot of CGI, like okay. moving forward.
That's cool. Yeah, it's the parts were designed to blend in and support yeah. the traditional
and
cell
there were
animation.
A few moments that you can kind of tell, but yeah, it still worked. I saw that there's over 80,000 hand-drawn cells that were used for this movie.
Oh wow. My God.
Which is just insane.
Wow, it says 10 minutes you use inked and painted, like a different technique. Wow, what is that technique? Inked and painted. It was used in all subsequent Studio Ghibli films, though.
Probably for what, like backgrounds and stuff? Maybe. Because like the landscapes have like a very like hand-painted look to them.
Like a watercolor.
Go back. Inked. Tradition. It just says like when I try to click on it, it's showing traditional animation, which is animation technique in which each frame is drawn by hand. The technique was the dominant form. I mean, this is just saying, that's just talking about animation.
Yeah.
Huh.
I don't know. Maybe because used to they would have like Xerox animation. You know.
Yeah.
We learned that in animation class. Mm-hmm. Yeah. From film school. That what was it? 101 Dalmatians was the first one to incorporate that. So maybe it was more of a return to more, instead of copying it and, you know.
I never got to learn that. And,
yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
We had a pretty cool class.
You missed out.
So what do you guys think about this? I want to see what your opinion would be. They had two titles that they thought about, and the one they went with is Princess Mononoke, of course, the English translation, but the other one was The Legend of Ashitaka.
Yeah, I know that Miyazaki preferred the latter, right? He wanted it to be called The Legend of Ashitaka.
Yeah.
I think Princess Mononoke is such a clever and smart name.
I think it works better for a Western audience because at that time, selling it to, you know, Disney built their empire off of princess movies.
Yeah.
So it kind of is a way to get people to believe it. Whereas now it's funny because I feel like for Disney, or at least within the past 10 years, 11 years, it wasn't as successful. Take, for instance, The Princess and the Frog didn't do as well as a movie like Tangled.
Yeah.
Even though Rapunzel fits within that Disney princess.
Well, there's been such a shift in the culture.
Yeah.
Like, and people now, I think it's almost a negative to like use, to like, you know, call your daughter a little princess, or people like have such. We have characters now that are like these strong female characters and everything, whereas before they were always like princesses, you know. So I think that's probably, it's like the culture has changed so much that now,
different than Sleeping Beauty,
right? Yeah. Exactly. Now it's like the Legend of Ashitaka might be a better title or something, or if it was instead of Princess Mononoke, it was something besides princess.
It's hard for me to think of this movie being called something else.
Yeah.
To me, the Legend of Ashitaka just sounds a little too generic.
Yeah.
I'll say going into it, not knowing anything about it, though, I was kind of confused because I was like, well, Ashitaka is obviously the protagonist.
Main, yeah.
But I was going like, when is the Princess Mononoke?
Wait till you play Legend of Zelda. That'll really throw you in for a loop.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Zelda because it came out in like the 80s. So on Nintendo, regular Nintendo.
That's when you know he was born in the 80s, when he calls it a regular Nintendo.
Yeah. What do you call it?
NES. Nintendo Entertainment System.
Oh, you call it NES?
Yeah, NES is what it was known as.
Nerds. All right, what's next, guys?
I think drawing back, I made this note where you talked about how Miyazaki is very much like anti-war, and that was an interesting thing. I read that he was influenced by the Yugoslavian war and conflicts to do this. And this was a movie he had been like working on from the 80s, right? Like he had these rough drafts. It was very much kind of a samurai film. And then he got to a point where it was like, this doesn't really... It's almost too like narrow in focus, and you know, once he incorporated kind of the environmental themes and figured out, you know, the plot with Iron Town, the humans really taking over nature, and it's this constant battle. You know, I think that's when he really hammered down the idea of the movie. But here's a quote from him that said, "You know, I learned that mankind doesn't learn." It felt like children were being born in the world without being blessed. How could we pretend to them that we're happy? And I think that's such
a very powerful quote
about, you know, the world of this movie as well, of like, you know, it's a really dark world that there is that goodness to it. There's that sense of happiness and everything, but humanity through their desire to grow more and more powerful or almost like pushing it back and not realizing at stake is, you know, more serenity.
Yeah. How did you feel about those themes in general for the movie? Like the entire like nature themes. How did you feel about Ashitaka kind of being like a neutral figure in the film itself versus Princess Mononoke? Like how did you feel with these conflicting themes and characters? Did anything stand out to you as weird, or do you think it all like kind of blended?
I felt like it worked really well, especially you know incorporating like Lady Eboshi. Like one thing in the featurette that I did see, it was interesting how they spoke to Miyazaki and they asked him, you know, you can never really tell. You know, sometimes the bad guys are making the right choices. You know, like no one's. It's such a humanistic way of looking at it where like the good guy might be messing up San, her whole view is so one-track minded that sometimes she's doing stuff in the wrong way, even though to her reasoning is solid, but you know she might be you know going about it and they're right. being harmed from it. So I think it's so complex for you know, before I saw the movie for the first time, you think it's just, oh, this really simple, you know, bare bones story. It's kind of whimsical. But then there's so many deeper and darker themes and like really diving into the gray area that is humanity.
Yeah.
You know, that like developing your culture and having, you know, going against nature, it's not all inherently bad. You have to have that balance with it, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's like it's like the expression "the road to hell is paved with good intentions." Yeah. You know, it's like everyone, even like the bad guys in movies, from their perspective, are doing the right thing, and that's really in real life too. Like, there's two sides to every story. You know, I like this quote from Billy Crudup, who voiced Ashitaka. He said, "The movie was such an entirely different experience. It had a whole new sensibility I'd never seen in animation. It had something profound to say." That there has to be a give and take between man and nature. Mm-hmm. One of the things that really impressed me is that Miyazaki shows life in all its multifaceted complexity without the traditional perfect heroes and wicked villains.
He has a lot of morally gray characters and individuals, and that honestly makes for better stories, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should take a quick break.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
That time, guys. We'll be right. Hey guys, we just wanted to take a quick second to tell you we have launched our Patreon page. It's a place where listeners can help support the show and gain access to exclusive content.
Now for $5 a month, our Patreon members get bonus episodes like our classic movie nights, where we watch classic films and talk in depth about what we liked, what hasn't aged as well, and how they achieved some of their special effects.
You'll also get early access to episodes before they're released to the public. And we'll give you a shout out on an episode of the show as well. Now this is a growing platform, so we'll be adding all kinds of new content over time, and you can gain access to all of it exclusively at patreon.com/friendsfromfilmschool.
You can follow at Sozo Bear Films on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel. Now let's get back to the show. You know what was funny was the parts where just like the kind of group of women when they were talking and stuff whenever he first gets to the town and they're like I guess hitting on him or whatever and then like all the get men are like we go out and risk our lives you know and it's just such a funny scene funny back and forth and they're like oh no why don't you come see where we live over here and
they're like we're gonna go work the things and makeup tonight or something
it's just funny it's weird seeing that stuff in this in a cartoon too for me still but it's just it's hilarious
I really like the whole dynamic of him like his first stay in Irontown
also Irontown reminds me of Mad Max
I
think of Bartertown.
Yeah.
Carry on.
Yeah, I don't know. I loved like the atmosphere, the people, and like playing into her morally gray side, Lady Eboshi, like getting to see how she's creating these guns to help the women take care of themselves. She's provided them a better life out of the brothels and gotten them into
ironworking.
She's taught them how to fight, defend themselves. Uh-huh. She's taking care of the lepers.
Yeah.
And all of her work is trying to work to a better future for everyone for the most part. It's just not in the benefit of the forest
yeah
in any sense.
Right. And I think she's morally gray because she's doing the right thing from her perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though she could be considered like a villain or something.
Yeah.
And then like going to the other side with like the animals and stuff. The boars were reckless. They wanted to defend their territory no matter what. Mm-hmm. And like the only real sensibility came from the wolves. But it was funny because like the mother of the wolves, I forget her name, Modo maybe?
Yeah.
Was that it?
I think it might be Modo.
Quasimodo.
She seemed like the most sensible compared to her daughter, San. And she provided almost like this like reasoning for that part of the story. But I don't know. I just kind of love how it all like kind of blends and clashes together.
Cool. It's like what you're saying, kind of says San and Lady Eboshi survive until the film's end, defying the usual convention of good triumphing over evil with the antagonist defeated. And this is a quote from someone. I'm not sure who the quote is. I'm sorry. They got their name here, but I don't know who they are. They, basically, though, they concluded that the resolution of the conflict is left ambiguous, implying that Lady Eboshi and San will be able to come to some sort of compromise. The ambiguity suggests that there are no true villains or heroes.
Mm.
Whoa. Dude.
I mean, it's a man versus nature story. Yeah.
Do you feel like this movie is almost too deep and a little too dark for kids?
I think so, yeah. I wouldn't show it to my child. Not when they're
people getting their heads and arms like getting ripped off. Even the demon stuff
could taking over the boars.
That stuff with the crazy like squiggly stuff was that would be pretty freaky if you were a kid.
Yeah. I like too the monkeys or the apes when they show up and it's just like shadowy figures with red, eyes. Like I don't know.
Yeah, so what about the little guys? What
the
do you call
them? Tree spirits?
Yeah, the little tree spirits. What were they called again?
I got it. They're Kodamas.
Kodamas.
Which are tree spirits for the most part. In traditional Japanese folklore, they take on the shape or appearance of a human. But Miyazaki kind of took the liberty, artistic liberty, mm-hmm. to create his own design for them. And
yeah, they're cool looking. Yeah.
It's really cool because that design directly influenced like the Koroks from Legend of Zelda, the Kokiri like children.
Okay.
If you played Wind Waker, they're the people with the like leaves over their face. Yeah. They're basically like a direct correlation to that, like borrowed from Miyazaki's work.
Wow.
Which is incredible.
Outreaching. You know that Dave Filoni, speaking of Avatar, he was majorly influenced by this film and Miyazaki's work.
Oh, cool.
So even the...
Tell him who Dave Filoni is,
too. Dave Filoni, he's kind of now the... He was like the right-hand man of George Lucas. He's taken over, along with Jon Favreau, the reins to The Mandalorian. Mm-hmm. He helped create The Clone Wars, the animated TV show, which... All that being said, the character of Ahsoka was influenced by San in this movie. So,
oh, cool. I would say Dave Filoni is the new, like, reigning expert of all things Star Wars.
He's like George Lucas's protege.
This man, you can tell how much he cares and loves about Star Wars when in a director roundtable for the season one of
Mandalorian,
he goes on a 7-minute, like, not even rant, just he starts
explaining the
explaining
lore,
explaining
spews
it
out.
And like, he just goes from, like, Darth Maul in episode one and, like, connects it all the way. Like, he redeemed probably what people didn't like about the prequels in like a 7-minute talk. And then Bryce Dallas Howard and Taika Waititi,
they're all like,
just like, yeah, okay, like, cool. Yeah.
Well, like, and oh, you know, you can tell how passionate he is because he's able to keep their attention and ours, the viewer, for 7 minutes of him just straight talking through
about
all
Star
the,
Wars.
Yeah, about Star Wars. But it's cool because it feels like he really understands George Lucas on a level that other people don't.
I feel like he understands George Lucas almost to a level George Lucas doesn't even
I think
understand.
So,
like, George Lucas is like, whoa.
I really do think that's true. I think it's like he sees what George Lucas was going for with the prequels or this or that. That sometimes I think George Lucas got in his own way with a lot of the stuff that, and you know what, I'm thankful that he did it because he's the one that pushed us forward with CGI and digital, you know. But
I think that's
like,
the one thing people always are quick to undermine with the prequels is just how much they helped with digital filmmaking.
Yeah, he changed the path of filmmaking forever, and whether you like the prequels or not, like, that they were necessary to be to for you to go watch Kong and Godzilla yeah. in such insane realism. Now
someone had to take the L.
Exactly.
Yep. Yeah.
And that was me at 6 years old dressing up as Jar Jar Binks for Halloween.
Wait, do we have a picture? Do you have a picture of that?
Because I might. I'll have to hit up my mom.
I hope you do, man.
That would be incredible.
They're like, why is your son wearing a dress or whatever?
My brother was Anakin in this pod racing gear. And
he got to be Anakin and you were Jar Jar?
I wanted to be Jar Jar. That's well, the thing.
That's why they made the character, yeah. dude. That was the genius of it. Yeah, Jar Jar Binks the costume.
Speaking of Avatar, though, another direct influence from Princess Mononoke was James Cameron's Avatar.
Oh.
Literally, like, he's come out and said that, like, this movie directly influenced Avatar from the characters to, like, the overarching themes of, like, man versus nature.
That's so weird because as soon as you said it, it makes sense. It, like, clicked. Yeah, but, yeah, I never would have thought about it, yeah.
Wait, back to Jar Jar Binks. Did it have, like, a real legit mask like this? Or?
No, the mask was... like that. It was just a
just the face.
Fate. Yeah,
that is terrifying.
Yeah,
it is kind of scary. Let's save that one.
I don't think I'd give that kid like Fig Newtons if he came up to my house for Halloween.
Oh yeah, this is
it. Okay, so it doesn't have like this one right here has like crazy feet and arms. I was like, what?
Oh no, this was definitely something from like a Walmart. Yeah, or CVS.
Okay,
but
sorry, side. Side tangent, but like the tree spirits, man. Yeah, I love the design. I really do, though. The design is so cool.
Speaking of design, Jar Jar Binks, right? Yeah.
What was really cool about the tree spirits, though, is like because there was a lot of attention to detail in this movie that I liked. The rattling was really cool, but I was more so like thinking whenever the Night Walker loses his head and goes crazy, he immediately. Destroys the forest, and as the trees die, you see all of the tree spirits, the Kodamas, falling out of the trees as they're dying along with their home, which I really appreciated. And also, just like attention to detail on its own, is there was a lot of stuff that I didn't see, the first time that I saw the second, like at the beginning when Ashitaka's like running to go up onto the watchtower with Jisan.
Is that like Jason?
No. So
with Jisan.
I'm pretty sure because Oji is grandpa in Japanese. So
OG he was, like
yeah.
Like Ice Cube
like
OG
Oji-san is grandpa. So he was just calling him like G or Jisan, and I think it was just like a nickname for grandpa. Like we would say like Papa or like
Pappy.
Yeah, Pappy. It's like the same thing as that.
Hey Pappy.
But, like, whenever he was going up, you could see, like, the dirt on his feet from, like, running, like, through the woods. Like, it was, like, such a quick shot, but his feet are covered in dirt. Like, the animations of, like, having to restring his bow.
Yeah.
And just stuff like that.
The attention,
was,
the detail.
Yeah, it was, like, so impressive. And, you know, we've talked about anime taking a lot of shortcuts.
Yep.
I don't feel like this one really did.
No, this one goes all out and shows everything.
I would say even more than Akira. Like I
think so too.
And it's probably the difference in like 10 years later almost of this movie coming out. But yeah, in Miyazaki's films, of the handful that I've seen, I just feel like they have that attention and detail they really go for. You know, the animation's so fluid, so beautiful.
Yeah. They're just such captivating stories too. With important themes and messages that, I mean, I feel like anyone, no matter like how big or small you are, like how young, how old, you can pick up on those themes and you can respect them.
And I also feel like it's whatever culture you're from, you understand them.
I was about to say that. I feel like we probably went about this in the worst way possible, but I feel like these are the most accessible, probably, anime films that I don't feel like. Like, even something, Attack on Titan or Akira, like, you almost have to be wanting to get into anime to start wanting to even be interested in those. Where I feel like this, like, if you watch one, you're like, oh, hey, this is good. You could be a fan of this and not be a fan of anime. Because I feel like there's that stigma, right?
I guess it was, like, trying to find a modern take on anime. Something that's like in the current like style and trend. Something that is like popular today.
And it's like you got, I mean, what, Ryan hit you up like and he wasn't.
He loves Attack on Titan. Yeah.
If anything, you got him into the show.
Yeah.
Too bad he's not alive anymore.
Yeah. Never forget him.
I feel like this is wrong. Just he made it safe home.
He made it safely home. Yeah, he's fine.
But yeah, I don't know. If I was going to show you something that was like more modern, that was a movie that's akin to...
He's going to say Your Name.
It would be Your Name.
Apparently,
well, too bad this is the last anime episode.
This is the last one. Looks like I'm done.
So I guess I'll never see anime again. I'm just kidding.
So speaking of Your Name, it surpassed Princess Mononoke. At the time, the most profitable, like successful Japanese or movie in Japan in 1997 was Princess Mononoke. It passed what movie? And it's not an anime film. What movie do you think was the most popular, like, for
Titanic.
10, 15 years? Not Titanic. It had been that way for since it came out in Japan.
It was that popular?
In Japan?
Yeah.
Wait, was it a... Did it come out in Japan?
It was an American movie.
Oh, okay.
Oh, Akira?
No.
An American movie. Sorry. Jurassic Park.
It's a Spielberg film, not Jurassic Park.
E.T. Yeah.
Wow. E.T. was super popular.
Apparently, it was
there.
Super big. It was the biggest box office film in Japan until 1997 when Princess Mononoke came out.
And Princess Mononoke reigned supreme until Your Name.
Spirited Away is the highest box office. So,
oh, really?
So then that and Howl's Moving Castle kind of knocked it down. So Miyazaki was beating himself, but now
like every
going
time.
Back to Your Name, it's now the third most successful or second, I forget.
And there's a website that's called My Anime List. That's like the IMDb anime, and it was number one for until this year when the Demon Slayer movie came out. But Your Name has like sat right above all of Miyazaki's movies, like,
which I feel like is a huge thing for Miyazaki's almost like the grandfather of.
I would say this guy's almost bringing back Miyazaki's like.
Legacy,
like style, and I don't know.
Let me tell you guys something. If we want to actually raise funds to make a movie, we just got to make a fan film because that's the way people do it.
For real.
This movie's called Wolf Girl, and it's a Princess Mononoke fan film. But they raised, I think, a pretty big budget, like 29,000
euros.
I guess it's euros.
Like,
they're in London.
30,000+.
How do you not get into like legal disputes though? About
you do usually. They usually when they post it online, they're like people. They make them take it down or something.
People got in huge trouble for making a Star Trek fan film. Like
Star Trek. What about the Power Rangers? People got in trouble for making a Power Rangers fan film.
It's almost one of those like it's the risk of you get kind of you can easily get notoriety online for it, and it almost helps you. You know, get your name out there because, you know, someone, whoever owns the rights is hitting you up saying, hey, you got to take this down.
Maybe. I think you can get by easier if it's like parody. If you're doing like parody, like what Corridor does, they're using like well-known things, but they're doing it in a way that they're putting a creative spin and it's mostly parody or something. But when you're literally, this is the story from Princess Mononoke set 600 years after the events. It's like a sequel, basically.
But it's live action.
Yeah, live action. The forests have regrown. The cities have been rebuilt, but the new balance between them is trembling. What if the forest needed a princess once again? Is what their thing says. So this one's legit. Just they're adding onto the story, which I know that's kind of
that's a little almost disrespectful.
Yeah,
and that's almost the thing too with like sequels. I guess it could play because Miyazaki says humans don't learn anything, so they keep on making the same mistakes.
Wow.
But it almost seems like it's a slap in the face, right? Of going like, hey, the resolution of this plot. Yeah, we're going to do this years in the future and find out no one learned anything.
Yeah. Right.
Also, to be successful and maybe not get in legal trouble, you could almost make just like a little like trailer. Like a minute trailer that's like you just go shoot some stuff and it's like a little like parody trailer or whatever, and then that might grow like and get some
money.
Yeah, because
they got over like $30,000.
Yeah, I mean they definitely raised the budget and they're in post production. It says.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't see the year. Wait, updated in 2015.
See, but that's the thing to me though. It's like all the iconic stuff, like, it's easy to pull from someone else's, like, things that have survived the test of time, you know? Mm-hmm. So people are like, yeah, of course I want to see Princess Mononoke in live action.
I want to see...
I wasn't talking for myself.
I just want to know if the movie actually came out.
Or if the person just took all the money and didn't make anything.
Right, or just, let's see. I'm just curious what happened with it. None of their stuff... I don't know if they actually finished.
They probably
the
got demonetized and can't like
lost all their money.
Yeah. Wait, let's see. Here's their YouTube.
My money. Can you file like a legal dispute?
Dude,
you donated money to GoFundMe
possibly.
And then
it looks like none of their stuff is like functioning anymore. So I don't know if they actually finished this movie.
They probably did.
Probably not.
I think they got sued and all of it was taken off the internet.
Yeah. What I love too about reading about the backstory of Princess Mononoke is that this was the last movie he did, or he came out of retirement, I think, to do this, or it was like he was going to retire.
I think this was going to be the last one and then he was going into retirement.
And then he comes back. I feel like from what I read, Miyazaki, he's constantly going, I'm going to retire. This is my last movie. He's like Jay-Z. Yeah, Jay-Z's like, hey, I'm done. I'm going to release this album.
Quentin Tarantino.
Rolling Stones. Rolling Stones. It's like, this is the farewell tour. ten times.
The fifth farewell tour.
Yeah. Tarantino though, he hasn't actually retired yet. We'll see if he sticks to it.
I don't think he will.
I don't think he will either. I think
I don't think so.
Speaking of making movies too much.
Speaking of Tarantino, he was asked to adapt the screenplay for this or for the dubbing, you know, and he said he didn't want to do it, and he recommended author Neil Gaiman to do it, all because his mother is a fan of Neil Gaiman. So
What? Wait, wow, so Tarantino's mom is a fan of
Neil Gaiman,
the writer?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's hilarious.
Who created, like, the Sandman comics, and, you know, I think he might have wrote Good Omens or something, too.
Good Omens was all right.
Yeah, look up Neil Gaiman. He's
Didn't
pretty
he do,
well
like, Doctor Who? He did that for, like, a while?
Maybe. He's pretty well-known. In the feature that I watched, he met Miyazaki, and he's like, I'm the guy who adapted your screenplay. But Neil Gaiman wrote two versions of the script of the adaption, and pretty much having to give them two options to appease Miramax, you know, the Western people who were distributing it, and the Studio Ghibli people. So he had to make sure everyone was happy.
Wait, so how did they combine those?
Yeah, I was like, which
I
one?
I think
they
went
with
one or no. It wasn't like one. He wrote two versions of like, hey, choose this.
Yeah. Oh, and then
but he was making sure it was like writing it, staying true to the original work, but you know, making sure the Western people who were paying to bring it over to the States were happy.
What'd you find?
So he wrote Coraline and Good Omens. Those are the two I recognize. The Graveyard Book, American Gods.
Yeah, which turned into like a Star series. He's like really big in the literary world.
Oh.
I thought it was like big in like a lot of like British TV too.
British TV, I think comic books. Yeah.
Yeah, he did write the Sandman.
Yeah. Mr. Sandman. Not the Metallica song.
Enter Sandman. He wrote that. Well, any last thoughts, guys?
Another cool fact that I found was, you know, making this movie, Miyazaki credits John Ford as a big inspiration. So again, like that early American, you know, stuff that he probably grew up on, mm-hmm. you know, Walt Disney's early cartoons, John Ford. So stuff like The Searchers with John Wayne, Stagecoach, but especially the film, I think it came out in 1946, My Darling Clementine mm-hmm. with Henry Fonda was a major inspiration of how to set up the towns and, you know, how Irontown kind of
frontier towns or whatever. Yeah.
So that's what I think is really cool about Miyazaki is he really pulls from, you know, American stuff. It's a similar thing to how Akira Kurosawa like pulled from old Western movies to make his samurai films, and then it got redistributed back into
now
the
we're
West.
In space westerns.
Yeah, it's space westerns, the spaghetti westerns. It's just that weird like. You know, I feel like especially Japanese films in Western cinema, you know, like mostly American stuff, it's always that back and forth.
Yeah.
And it just keeps like getting new like spins on it with each like each time it's borrowed. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. It's like building itself up into its own like thing.
Everything leads to the Mandalorian. I firmly believe
all
that.
Roads lead to the Mandalorian. Yeah.
This is the way.
Jar Jar will be in the Mandalorian season 3.
Oh my gosh, you think so?
You think so? I hope that he kills him immediately.
No, here's my thing.
He couldn't.
Okay, I think they'll bring a Gungan.
Is that the race?
Yeah.
Gungan.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I dressed up as one for this Halloween. Guy.
Brad knows. He knows about the Gungans.
Misa hate the Naboo.
Yeah, like the... Well, they didn't all... Like, Jar Jar looked... really crazy, but what about his like the king or
the
whatever?
King he had the giant yeah he's like
they all were just weird.
My favorite
very
thing
freaky.
I got this later but as a kid, you know, the toys from episode one had those little dog tag type stuff that if you had the remote control or battery powered, you set it on there and it would like read off their lines from the movie.
Yeah,
I got that finally at one point, and it was so cool. But the king, I had the toy, and he's like, "Misa hate the Naboo," and then it would play all these different little clips. The droid would be like,
"Where are you taking them?"
Like that. I just have those stuck in my head.
It's just there forever.
I had a 40-year-old virgin figurine someone gave me, and you push it, and it would say lines from the 40-year-old virgin, like when he's getting waxed.
Wait, are you
like,
serious? Screw,
I'm not kidding. Okay, this is a real thing. It was like a thing.
I thought you were just making fun of me. And
no,
I was like,
no.
I almost thought that's what he was doing, too.
This thing
like,
was real.
Damn.
And you could push a button on it, and it would say lines from the movie. Like when he's like, oh, Kelly Clarkson.
That's amazing.
Oh, man.
Did you have to wax it to make it?
Yeah, it came with little strips, and you like wax his chest, and it would scream. I'm just kidding. I made that part up.
Oh,
the other part was true. Okay.
Well, that's everything we know about Princess Mononoke.
That's everything we know about anime.
So have
we've conquered.
Have
it.
You been convinced to watch more anime?
I'm convinced that I see the value in the art form.
Nice.
And I think I would watch more. I still don't know if I'm like a super fan, but this one was really good.
Would you feel like you would watch more Miyazaki stuff since you liked this one?
Yeah, for sure.
Would it be like it'd be a group setting if like we were all going to hang out and be like, let's watch this.
Yes.
That's when you would watch
it. Oh, definitely. I think it would be a lot more fun too if we could watch these together.
Yeah.
It would have been a lot more fun.
We could poke fun at the dubbing.
I think too, like the way you talked about it before we got on here, you know, your wife Carrie, she's like, I'm not going to watch this.
She doesn't want to watch anime. So over the weekend, like, we have to watch the movies and be ready for the podcast because we record on Mondays. So I'm like, I got to find some time to watch this.
Alone, which means, because my wife doesn't.
Which means I can't hang out with my wife and watch it or whatever because she's like, I don't really want to watch
my
this
wife
movie.
Or my work.
Yeah. So it's like, it would be cool if we could watch some. I don't know if we even have done any like that since we started the podcast.
We should, because that would be amazing.
Yeah, because we started this like thing with the Terminator way back, and then we all just watched it on our own. We should definitely watch some together. Yeah,
I think it would be way more fun.
All right.
Well,
come to my house for a movie night. It's a perfect excuse.
Is that to the fans of the podcast or to us?
Here's his address.
Everyone's invited.
Just punch this into Google Maps. Here we go. Ready? Get a pen.
Podcast ends.
Well, that was another go at Friends from Film School. I hope you enjoyed our deep dive into anime. If you want to be a fan, you know, support the Patreon. Follow us at Friends from Film School podcast on Instagram. You can find us on YouTube. Please subscribe.
Also follow Luke on TikTok.
Yes, TikTok.
We do have a TikTok now. It's under my name. Just look up The Luke Pilgrim. We're doing a lot of crazy stuff on there. We've had some really awesome success so far.
Yes.
We got over 70,000 followers, and like one video has 1 million views, which is insane. So we're trying to grow that, and hopefully we're going to that translate over to the YouTube channel as well. So
also, all your TikTok followers seem to be anime fans, so I think there's a correlation there.
There's lot of
there's a ton
TikTok
of them.
I mean fans of anime on TikTok.
I think too, if you listen, you know, send us a voice message through Anchor or
give us
a review on Apple Podcasts.
Yeah,
you know, let us know, you know, if you're a fan. Hit us up.
Especially people all if you're in another part of the world.
Yeah,
we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah.
All right, that's it, guys.
Yeah, catch y'all later.
See ya.
Okay, goodbye.